Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us. On today's episode, we talk with Caleb Nygaard, an economics researcher at the Yale Program on Financial Stability and a popular educator on the Federal Reserve. We talk to him about the new playbook he's helping to write on how to fight systemic risk. This interview was recorded in August of 2020. I hope you enjoy it.
We're here today with Caleb, who is a research associate at the Yale Project on Financial Stability, working on the new Bagehot project. Bagehot project. How do you pronounce that?
Bagehot. You got it.
Okay. Yep. And he's writing a digital playbook for fighting financial crises. He's also the editor of a truly excellent podcast called The Central Verse, or the Bankster Podcast. And if you're looking to get into learning about central banking, I highly recommend you check it out. It's a really great way to get hooked into that world. Makes it really easy without sparing any of the important details. So with all that said, Caleb, how did you get into the central bank pedagogy business?
Sure. And first off, thanks for having me on. Really look forward to seeing everything that you guys put together. So I won't go too far back, but as small background, I grew up in real small towns, about half the childhood in southern Utah, and then a little bit of time in eastern Idaho. So I was about as far removed from the central banking world as you can imagine. But I had a great undergrad econ 101 professor who had a really interesting background. He had spent some time. Did most of his career within the Fed on the operations side, working in check processing. Huh. And when the Fed...
So real deep into the plumbing.
Oh, very much so. And one of the pipes of the many financial plumbing pipes that the Fed runs. And this pipe, as you know, was dying. The amount of checks that were being processed were really shrinking down. And so they consolidated where they used to... The Fed used to process checks at all 12 of the reserve banks and many of the 30 plus branches that was getting shrunk down. And he decided he didn't want to move to Atlanta, which is where the Fed consolidated their check processing plant to. And so he left and decided to go into teaching. And so had some really interesting perspectives from him. He helped me land a job at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And it was a really big win for me. I started with an internship there and was really excited to be there. I had wonderful experience, both being in the big city, coming from small farming towns, as well as being within the walls of the central bank itself. I had applied to two internships, not really knowing much about how the Fed works at all. One was in research and one was within statistics. And in my head, those were almost synonyms, right? I ended up getting an offer for the statistics one and not for the research one. Got there, found out that they're very different. But I found that I enjoyed the statistics work. We were a more appropriate name would probably be data processing, data analytics, collecting lots of interesting data. But it wasn't really super intellectually
stimulating. So were you contributing to any of the colorful books at that point?
Yeah, so I wasn't contributing. Nope. So I wasn't involved in any of the Beige Book surveys or any of the FOMC prep on a Tealbook or anything like that. No. So I within statistics, I was responsible on a team responsible for kind of two data sets. I split my time about half the time. I was responsible for the National Information Center, which handles structured data. So like, where are the financial institutions physically? Who owns them, and then how are all the banks interrelated? And then the other half of the time I spent working on the reference rate data. So the Fed funds rate, the SOFR, and the kind of the three rates that go into that, which is the replacement for LIBOR. happy to talk about that as much or as little as we're interesting. But it, you know, it was good work. It was interesting. These are really important things that the Fed does, but it really wasn't super intellectually stimulating. And so, you know, when you're a student, especially in undergrad, there's a lot of structure to your education. You know, there's a lot of read this specific thing, answer these specific questions, or write, and your writing prompt is quite direct. And I did that fine. I enjoyed it while I was there, but I was really excited to graduate from undergrad and have time to just explore my interests in central banking history and in the institutional history of the Fed. I got about 7 months out of undergrad, looked around at my bookshelf, and realized I had not cracked a single book. I hadn't cracked a single book. I'd read very little. I had, done very little study. And, you know, it made me kind of question. I was like, well, is it because I'm maybe not as interested in it as I thought I was? Or is it that I just don't kind of incentives to do the study? And so I decided, well, I needed to give myself something to push. I was really into podcasts, had been into podcasts for a long time, back in the old days when I'd download Wait, Don't Tell Me onto my early iPod. And I thought, well, I'll do a central banking podcast, mostly because nobody's out there is doing one, surprisingly, and two, because it would give me a reason to do the thing that I actually know I like to do. I toyed with that for a couple of months. And then I remember you guys were in Chicago. So it was off the purple brown Belmont train stop up there on the north side. There's a 24-hour diner, which I think actually went out of business really sadly. It's been around for a really long time. Can't remember what it's called. My wife and I were in there, a girlfriend at the time. We're talking and we were just doodling little potential logos on a napkin. I was like, I've got my story now for how this started. I've got this napkin.
You got the napkin, right?
I've got the napkin. So that's kind of how it started. Mostly just to force myself to do something I know I would love doing.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that's what this podcast is about as well.
Very much so. Like, there's a bunch of books that we have on our shelves or in our computers, I guess, at this point. It's like, I wasn't reading those, and now we have to. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting. There's a lot of different ways that you can go about it. And so, you know, I did the podcast, solid for about 2 years. It was not a great production quality podcast. It was basically me just reading an essay.
Oh, totally disagree. I think it's super high quality.
that's very kind. I'm very jealous of where you guys are at right now. And the technology, even in the 4 or 5 years since I started, has significantly improved. But you know, there are a lot of good things that a podcast can do. It's really good for telling stories, for exploring ideas, for having, deep conversations that you get hints of, on Twitter, which is another good place. And there's often some intellectual conversations and interesting dialogue.
Yeah. We met on Twitter.
We did. Yeah, absolutely. That's how we all connected. But there is something about sitting down and talking out loud. One thing that audio isn't great at is explaining complex structures, though. Right? The podcasts don't serve necessarily as a great, if you have a question about what's the selection process for the Reserve Bank presidents of the Federal Reserve?
Right.
And I can walk you through the 16-step process on a podcast, and I did that. But it was grappling with this idea that prompted me to start the website Centralverse. My brother had just graduated some coding experience, and so he decided that he'd help me out. They're very different things. Podcast is really great for storytelling and for having deep conversations, and then for kind of explaining the complexities of how central banking work. I do that on the Centralverse website. So it's been fun. It's a really great world to be in. A lot of, the academics and the journalists are in this kind of central banking world are surprisingly approachable. And it's a really good world to be in. You know, I think it's in this time, it's also worth noting that that's not always the case for everyone. And I think, the economics world is going through a righteous reckoning. but hopefully it will only make the world more opening for more people.
Can you say a little bit more about that? Just what you're referencing for listeners who might not be following the Harold Ulig story on Twitter?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yep. It's the professor at the University of Chicago that had some unfortunate past comments. You know, I'll be honest, most of my understanding of this comes from Claudia Sam, who was an economist at the board, came in right as the crisis was bubbling in 2007, and then was there for, I want to say, close to a decade. Anyway, she shared a lot of experiences about what it's like being a woman in the economics field and some of the trials. And she's not only shared her own story, but a lot of experiences that others have had, other women and people of color that have really struggled to make it, you know, at different levels of the career. There have been interesting and important conversations that Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen have been leading at some of the big kind of economic clubs and economic groups. And so, you know, Jay Powell himself, as the current chair of the Fed, has explicitly commented on wanting to improve the culture and making sure that it's a warm place.
That Claudia Sam blog post was really, I think, powerful. We'll definitely put that in the show notes for listeners who are interested. Yeah. So how has your podcast been received? You know, you've got really great capsule episodes of like singular concepts where it's like, okay, this week we're going to talk about this one minute subset of the central verse. And you like really just explain it in like very simple English. But then over the course of three seasons, you know, you accumulate 70, 80 episodes, you know a lot about the central verse. How's your audience been?
Yeah, so it's been fun to put it out there. When I was in Chicago starting it, you know, I was in a 300 square foot tiny studio. you just click publish and see what happens. I'd say, you know, it reached a lot of people for what I thought it would, for what I thought I would see. I've gotten feedback from people from, you know, as all over the world, from Nordic countries to the Middle East.
So there's a real global interest and hunger for this.
Definitely. Oh yeah, definitely. Like I said, there's just not enough. I think there's something about central banking that's at a really interesting point in that if you imagine kind of a ratio of like importance of a topic on the top divided by like how much current knowledge there is. Like, I don't know if there's a topic more ripe or with more low-hanging fruit for knowledge dissemination than central banking itself.
100% agree.
And so, you know, it's always tricky trying to nail the right target audience. You know, are you shooting for a Planet Money listener? Are you shooting for a high school teacher? Are you shooting for, you know, the financial markets? You know, what are you shooting for? The farmer friends that I have in Idaho. You know, so there are different levels, but I think there's a lot of low hanging fruit in a lot of those areas. So I got a little bit of that, and then you know, those have been.
Yeah, it seems like right now the podcasts that exist are just like by central bankers for central bankers.
Yeah.
Right. Like Macro Musings is just an incredible podcast. Yeah. But if you want to, if that's your first exposure to this stuff, it's going to blow your mind even, you know, the opening 30 seconds.
Yeah.
They're already just flying into the heights of abstraction. So
that's right.
And that's kind of what we're trying to do on this podcast as well, is like sort of mediate between the really important world of central banking, which can be a bit exclusionary because of the identity issues we talked about, but also just because of the technical language. It's very unfamiliar.
Yeah.
But I think you can get a lot of the really basic knowledge that you need to know pretty quick if there are good pedagogues out there that are willing to do it.
That's right.
Like I think people were talking today about the need to write a history of the Fed.
Yeah.
Usually, like one doesn't even exist, right? Like they're all written by economists for other economists.
Right.
It's, you know, I mean, you think about like all the histories of tax policy or spending policy or the New Deal that get written. And the fact that we don't have a single history of the Fed by historians, it's just, I mean, that's why I became an historian, honestly, is just to try to tell the story to a much larger audience. So I'm really, your podcast is perfect for that.
Well, yeah, thank you. Yeah, there's some people that are doing some great works, you know, but yeah, we haven't had a good solid history of the Fed. Alan Meltzer did a really dense one, but there again, target audience
3,000 pages
of academics. That's right. You know, Mark Spindle and Sarah
Binder. Yep.
Blinder did a nice one. Yeah, thank you on kind of the Fed's relationship with Congress. And then Peter Gunty Brown has a big one coming out. I don't know if it's coming out, I think midtime next year. Mm-hmm. But like you said, I mean, when you think about that ratio again of like how much now, you know, how much there is to know or how much is already known, there's a lot that could happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's exciting. I think we're all participating in a slow understanding, a slow but gradual increase in understanding of the importance of central banking. And I think, you know, of this past crisis, the blurring of the lines of that have always been blurry, but have been particularly blurry between, you know, what the president, the Congress, and the Fed do and how they interact about financial policy, which ultimately, you know, we always have to remind ourselves that, and I try and do this on the podcast as often as possible, but remind ourselves that, you know, the economy is us, right? Like it's our jobs, it's our livelihoods, it's our families. So these decisions, you can quickly become, you know, intellectual or up in the clouds, but they
alienated,
have real
perhaps.
Important. Yeah. They have real important impacts.
Yeah. I mean, I guess on that point, and on the topic of, you know, bringing these ideas to people and beyond just the universe of central bankers and economists.
Sure.
Like if you had to pick one or two points that you wish that, you know, everyday people would understand about central banks or about the Federal Reserve, are there any particular ideas that you're trying to get across?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the first and like almost the gate to coming in is just that it's possible. Like that's what I try and tell people. I used to give tours at the Money Museum at the Chicago Fed, which was a really fun volunteering part. It really was. No, it was a blast. We'd have from as young as preschoolers to nursing homes send, you know, groups in. And, you know, that was always my first comment is that, you know, that this is an important institution and it matters. And two, it's possible. It's possible to grasp some of the basic concepts as to why it matters. I find personalities to be a great way of entering this world. And so, you know, whether that's learning about people that have made an impact on central banking in the past or the present, you know, having some background into who are these people that lead the Fed and, you know, where did they come from and what are they trying to do? Those are kind of the two points that I think are the ones that I do is one, just under basic understanding that it's possible to understand this stuff and to find meaning and interest in it. Mm-hmm. It's rewarding. And the second being that if you approach it through who are these different people involved, mm-hmm. what are their incentives and what are the rules that they work within?
No, that makes sense. I mean, if you just from the outside think about the central bank, it can feel like such an impersonal institution. Yep. It doesn't seem like the kind of place that has a personality attached to it or that has individuals running around, you know, making decisions and taking action. So I think, yeah, getting that across is really, really helpful.
There are specific historical structural reasons for that as well, right? So like Greenspan, for instance, is one personality who, if you try to watch any of the like many hours of video attached to him, instantly comes across as someone who has no personality, right? Because like, I mean, it's an intentional just like
on
wall
purpose.
Of obfuscation. Maestro, he's very mysterious. For a long time, the best book on the history of central banking was by a journalist in the 80s, William Grider, titled Secrets of the Temple.
That's right.
And I think that's for a few generations now, that's kind of what it's been, is just this institution that purposefully hides what it's doing. And then, of course, since 2008, especially with the rise of the Tea Party movement, Ron Paul and the Fed types, there's been a lot of these attacks on the Fed. And so to defend itself, obviously it has to produce this alienated condition. But arguably that's not the ideal situation.
Yeah. So. Yeah. We're in a really interesting transition phase in central banking in a lot of ways, but one that I think we're almost to the point where we can look back and say, you know, a lot of it has already happened. It was just this incredible increase in transparency into what the central bank does now, did in the past, and will do. You know, the central bank talks more about all three of those things to a degree that would be unrecognizable to anyone just 25 years ago. Yeah. And so that transparency, that, you know, that opening up also is another thing that allows for a more public reckoning with what does the central bank do and why.
Yeah, and I know that the Fed has also been really engaged in its own education projects, right? It's got its own history website up that's very good. And it has its own institutional perspective, of course. But
yeah, there's the Fed is doing some interesting work. Yeah, they're definitely doing some good interesting work. The folks at the St. Louis Fed, and in particular, you know, they're to those interested, Federal Reserve history or Fed history. .org.
We'll put the link in the show notes
run,
as well.
You know, they run some great resources that are pretty accessible and easy to navigate. They've got great data sets in FRED, Fred, and then they've got some great non kind of number data stuff in something called Fraser. And then the San Francisco Fed has some fun elementary school creating projects for how to talk about that stuff. So they are definitely opening up, and individual people within the different feds have spoken out more. You know, to think that we'd have somebody like Neil Kashkari so active and engaged you know, he really engages.
As a Minnesota boy, I'm very proud of the Minneapolis Fed, because Neil, and then even before him, Narayana Kocherkoda, just rules in terms of public engagement. And
that's right. And so it's an interesting time that we're in.
Yeah, never more so now in the past couple of months, I suppose. Which I guess brings us to the other aspect of your own personality, which is that during your day job, you're writing this this playbook for financial crises at Yale.
Yeah, that's right. So after about 4 years at the Fed, I decided that my intellectual curiosity was being satisfied by the podcast and by Centralverse, the website. I got to work on some projects with some senior people that were, you know, 10 to 15 years ahead of me. And realized that the work that and got a real good look at what the work that they were doing was, and just decided that central banking operations wasn't necessarily where I thought I would be most happy in the long term, and so was looking for something else. Andrew Metrick is a professor out here at Yale that has done some really important work, but one of the things that he did was put up a free Coursera class about the financial crisis of 07, 08, and 09. And he did it with Tim Geithner, which is, he was the New York Fed president and then Obama's first Treasury secretary. So that was kind of the hook as I was just, you know, looking for other stuff to, you know, like I said, just keep myself learning and engaged in something that I'm interested in. So I started poking around this professor to see what he's doing. And he had recently started a master's degree in systemic risk. And he had started, which I began to poke around and thought, well, if I need some further education, maybe I'll start poking around there. Got in touch with him and some of his staff. And they said, well, you know, maybe you should talk to another person, Christian McNamara here, who's kind of one of the heads of this program that we have that's a sister to the master's degree. Like you said, creating a financial playbook. So the story for kind of how this project began was really, like I said, Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke, who after the crisis had ended, both the kind of immediate liquidity crises of the kind of 08 period, early 09, once that had mostly ended and And then there were some, you know, they had quantitative easing later on. There were other stuff that the Fed did. But as those ended and they kind of had a time to sit back and reflect, you know, they began to express some frustrations with the crisis fighting preparedness that the government had, mostly within the central bank, but also across the federal government. And the, you know, their comments, they've made these comments, both of them have made these comments publicly before, but basically, you know, when they, in the midst of the crisis, when they turned to their deputies and said, hey, where's the playbook? Like, where's the to-do list? Where's the list of, hey, this works, hey, this doesn't work. And they Bernanke jokes that he said he was given a one page piece of paper with the words "open the discount window" on the front. He said that's our financial crisis playbook.
Yeah, I think Larry Summers famously said that pretty much all of modern macro was useless compared to going back to Lombard Street by your namesake.
That's right. My pseudonym on the podcast. No, you're absolutely right. It's a sacred text of macro policy. And so, you know, and Metric has even said that that's, you know, our, within Yale's program on financial stability, one of our kind of our flagship project is called the New Badgett Project, which is just this idea of like, let's go back and take a look with today's technology and with our access to data, mostly qualitative. Most of our work is qualitative. But yeah, so, you know, what we're trying to do is build an online platform that policymakers and those in the policymaking world, that's the target audience. So it's not necessarily written for academics. It's not necessarily written for the broader public, but it's written for that group that are going to be having to make decisions. And the idea is let's make a tool that can be used during peace times to educate and train them. And then a tool that would also be useful during a wartime, which meaning a financial crisis. And so it's based on it's based on these case studies that we write. So we've got a kind of a master list of financial crises, and then within each crisis we have all of the interventions. And this is across the world and as far back as we can go. In fact, maybe 6 months ago, maybe it was longer, maybe it's been a full year, we hired Paul, I'm not going to pronounce his German last name correctly, Schmelzing.
The 700-year guy.
That's right. So he's that's exactly right. So he, you know, he's done some really cool work.
Just incredible.
Yeah. Yep. So he's a postdoc here working with us to document just finance. We're just trying to get all the financial crises and all the interventions. And then what we do is we write a 20 to 40 page case study on each of the interventions. And wow, those are interesting and useful in and of themselves. But similar to an academic study, if that was our final product, it honestly wouldn't be that helpful. Because if you tell a policymaker, you know, what should I've got all these bad assets on the bank, right? Like, let's just for simplicity's sake, you know, you've got this housing crisis, and now there's all of these mortgages that are not very good, and they're bringing down banks. Balance sheet, these banks are going to collapse, and that's going to
that ever happen though?
The economy. I mean, so hypothetically speaking.
Okay. I'll grant you that.
And so, you know, what should we do? Well, I know one option that policymakers have is they could create, they could kind of split the bank in half. They could leave the good assets with the bank, and then all the bad assets. Bad is kind of a bad word because it doesn't. It just means like all the bad stuff would just be the stuff that we don't know. Like, we don't know if it's good or bad. And that's what makes financial panics scary, is just there's so much uncertainty. But anyways, that's one of the tools that policymakers have, is they can kind of split it off, and then the government can take control of the bad one. They can sit on it for a couple of years until the crisis is over, and then they can unwind it in a way that's not destructive to society. Now, if you take that and you're like, okay, well, who has done asset management companies before? You know, I wrote a handful of cases in a package of about, you know, 25 or 30 that we have. And this isn't even all of them, but we've got these 30 case studies. So if you were to give a policymaker 30 case studies, you know, that in and of itself, although is interesting, you'd have to have a really big army of RAs and people to, and lower level people to go through it. And they'd have to disseminate and try and pull out the kind of the lessons and everything. And so our kind of response to that is we write these case studies, and then these case studies get kind of chopped up and put into an online interactive platform. And on this platform, for example, with this asset management company, I'll use, keep using this as an example, you'll have maybe like 20, you know, 20 questions, 20 key design decisions that somebody making, creating an asset management company would want to answer. And then what we've done is, so you can imagine kind of a table where we've got these 20 important questions that someone would need to ask. And then we've got across the top, we've got all of these different examples. And so then you'll be able to see how all of these different countries in all of these different crises answered these different types of questions. And you can, you know, you'll be able to click into it, and then it'll open the full case study if you want to go deeper.
Oh, so it's a dynamic web.
It'll be, it'll be a dynamic, interactive tool that hopefully, like I said, will be not only useful in training where you are at a slower pace, but that it'll genuinely be useful for policymakers on the fly, having to, you know, if you're the number two or number three guy at whatever institution or girl, and the boss asks you to, you know, hey, give me three or four ideas of how we could do this, you'd be able to do it in a pretty short amount of time. And you'd be able to do it having synthesized an amount of information that's just not available anywhere else. So that's kind of the
I should also make a plug just for any historians out there who are interested in financial history. I mean, this is just it's literally an encyclopedia of every fact you would possibly need to know. So I think it's incredibly useful.
That's the idea. We needed this. If COVID was going to happen, no matter what, we really needed it to happen next year, not this year. the platform is not live yet. It's still in development stages. But comes out. It's scheduled to come out. Actually, I shouldn't say when it's scheduled to come out. It's coming out in the next couple of years. It'll be out and being used across the system.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, just like the idea of having all of that history. Yeah. It's like, these are things that have happened periodically and different approaches have been taken at different times, and we can actually learn from that. That's such a useful thing to have. Are there any, like, have you all been able to distill any sort of, you know, rules or ideas, you know, best practices out of these different crises that you've been analyzed?
I think that's one of the strengths of the case study method is that you can particularize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it is interesting. We tread a delicate line in all of this, in that we source our material. So we have another smaller project, but smaller only in public view, but incredibly important project. And that's creating a ginormous database of primary sources of all of this stuff. So, you know, back to that one more time, that asset management company, you got this table in front of you. You could click in, you could open, you could see a case study, and then you could see, okay, well, I actually want to see the contracts that the government had, you know, how did the government design the contracts that the banks would sign in handing off their assets from, you know, the healthy bank to the government owned kind of bad bank. Mm-hmm. And so we've got this, we're building this huge database, resource library of primary source material. And so you'll be able to go in and access, you know, all of that information. That's also, you know, a really important part of it. Now, remind me, what was your question?
Oh, yeah.
Specifically,
I was just curious if you had any sort of, you know, have you? Yeah, lessons. I guess
lessons. Okay, so that's where I was going with this. Lost my train of thought. So you could imagine all these primary sources lead into or feed into these case studies. Mm-hmm. One other thing that leads into the case studies is these what we call lessons learned interviews. Mm-hmm. We take these primary source documents and then we try and talk to the people that wrote them. or were in the rooms where they were designed. And so, you know, we'll take and we'll say, you know, you set the interest rate that you were going to charge in this program above what was relevant in the market price at the time. Like, why did you do that? Or, or why did you restrict, you know, executive compensation at this stage and not that stage, et cetera. Anyways, so we're talking to these people. They're an important part of the input into this material. And so we, in our final products, we want to make sure that we're maintaining really good relationships with all of these people. And so we present the information as much as we can, especially if programs made changes. But the amount of prescription that we do, as far as, you know, definitely do this or definitely don't do this, we do that. And another area of the interactive digital platform is going to be, there are going to be some color coding. So there are going to be some things that are colored, but we had to take some steps back as to which colors we were choosing and how we were phrasing it, only mostly because, you know, these, there are, there's all, if you just flag a decision as good or bad, that's never the full story, right? And so we often find it, it can be distracting. But we do, but we are going to be highlighting things that were interesting, positive, and interesting, negative.
So this is also just a massive oral history project.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, that's and absolutely right.
That's incredible. So that strikes me as a very different form of knowledge than what you might typically expect from an elite economics program, right? I mean, like, typically what you expect in terms of knowledge there is something highly positivistic and formal, right? Like, for many years, the way to write an econ paper was introduction, data, mathematical model, policy prescriptions, right? Like, and that was just it. And, you know, the equation, you could skip to the equations if you didn't care about all of the stuff in between. But this strikes me as having a much more, well, literary quality, I mean, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We are purposely, we also have a journal, and but it's not, it's specifically not an academic journal. There, you know, our work doesn't go through the regular, you know, academic review, referee process. Our audience is just different. Like, our purpose is just different. And we also don't do a lot of quantitative work. Most of our work, you know, we tap into quantitative work that has been done by others, and we include that. There are evaluation sections to all of these cases that we're writing. So, you know, what have academics, what have, you know, how did journalists respond? How did academics respond? What's in real time, and then in hindsight as well. So we're gathering that information, but the material that we're producing is almost exclusively qualitative. And yeah, and you're right. And it is very different than what's happening elsewhere.
Super cool.
So how has COVID changed what you guys are up to? Have you rolled out the playbooks in the way that you expected? Sure. Has it gone according to the rules?
So we definitely made some pivots. We like I mentioned, the platform itself, this tool, this interactive tool, wasn't ready. And so what we did do, we did kind of two things. One, we just mass published all of our case studies. So we put all of those case studies online. Like we've talked about, you know, it's not the ideal form for that material to be in, but they have gotten a good amount of traction with policymakers, and we've gotten some good feedback that they've used them and found them useful. So we did put up all of that information, and then we switched our writing temporarily to basically writing policy memos. So we stopped writing cases, these historical cases, and we shifted all of our work to these documenting these policy actions taken around the world. And an important part of that was tracking them. So we have a ginormous Google spreadsheet. It still lives in the Google spreadsheet I started in mid-March, although people way more qualified than me are making it much prettier and much nicer. But we've documented over 4,000 financial interventions. We started just with monetary policy stuff, but we're backlogging or backfilling fiscal policy and macroprudential policy as well. So it's going to be a really massive, massive day. So that took a good, you know, I'd say almost a third of our team was dedicated almost full time these last 6 months to just trying to keep track of everything that everyone's doing. And so that was a huge part. And then, yeah, we write these policy memo blog posts.
Can I ask, is that massive spreadsheet? Is that global then?
Yep.
Okay. Oh.
Yep.
And what's the sort of, I mean, I imagine there's a huge amount of variation in terms of how different countries have been approaching this. Are there sort of, particular aspects of that stand out in your mind?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that is easy to pull out as far as like interesting things that we've noted so far have to do with timing. And, you know, I'd say maybe a couple of things about timing. One, you know, we saw what happened in the developed world or the, you know, in the more financially advanced world. We saw all of that happen early in the crisis, and there was a wave of, and then there was a similar wave of actions taken by central banks and by fiscal authorities. Mm-hmm. So finance ministries or treasuries that took similar steps. And then we saw, you know, delayed by a couple of weeks up to maybe a month, we saw almost the same approach taken just in the developing world. And all of those are, you know, those boundaries are rough and simplifications in general, but there definitely was a, you know, a push of, you know, what central banks are good at is acting fast and acting, you know, dramatically or putting, you know, a lot of power into play really quickly. Mm-hmm. And so we saw that happen very fast. It was one of the most important takeaways from the Great Recession. The response to that was act early and act strong. And so we saw that from central banks. That was a to be honest, quite impressive, the degree to which central banks internalized that lesson of the 2007, 8, 9 period.
The executive committee of the bourgeoisie has to have executive capacities. It actually has to be able to make decisions.
You got to be able to move pretty quick. That's right. And so, you know, so that was impressive. Congress moved pretty fast here in the United States. Other areas of the world put out some fiscal policy pretty early on as well. But we saw that, and because we saw such a strong response, financial markets themselves, despite some early shakings, have stabilized quite well and did quite early on. There are always disruptions, but so that acting quickly was important. You know, one big takeaway that we've seen is that almost every country underestimated how long this problem would last, and most of them, is a kind of a subpoint of the first, but most of them also underfunded or had to add additional funding to their rescue efforts. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the early kind of takeaway pieces that I wrote with a colleague of mine, Mallory Dreyer, one of the big takeaways was that, hey, you know, kind of, this is just a warning, just to let you know, you know, world, especially to the developing world that is a few weeks to a month behind the developed world in responding to this crisis, basically go as big as you can. And be careful about tying it to a time that's too short. Politics always get in the way. You know, it's amazing what governments can do in a moment of crisis. A previous project of the Yale Program on Financial Stability was helping Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and Ben Bernanke work on a kind of a 10-year reflection book, kind of two 10-year reflection books that they did. And a quote that Hank Paulson likes to say frequently is, you know, never bet. He says never bet against the American government during a time of crisis. And I think to a certain degree, you know, that came through in, I heard him last say it last fall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to think when he was saying that last fall, in the fall of 2019, to think that the government could come together was quite startling. To think that they would be able, you know, that the Congress and the president would pass a $2 trillion stimulus program was just, you know, unimaginable. And so I think it speaks to that. But I say that just because, you know, we saw that a couple of months ago, and although it had its moments where we didn't know how big it would be or if it would be enough, it turned out not to be enough. And we're having a harder time now with this, you know, we're recording in early August before anything has been passed through the U.S. Congress. But it gets harder over as the kind of the initial explosion of whatever the crisis is as it goes. So that importance of time is something that has come up.
All right. Well, we're almost running out of time. But while we have you here, we did want to ask you about Mariner Eccles, since you're one of the running series you have on your podcast is about this just wonderful, incredible figure. Yep. There was even a conversation on Twitter this morning, everyone urging you to write that biography, since in a lot of ways you were sort of born for it. But no pressure here. But
not at all. No,
What's your fascination with him?
Yeah. So, well, to be honest, you know, I heard about Mariner Eccles for the first time in that undergrad econ class, and I was just blown away. Not even necessarily about the accomplishments or the historical importance of Mariner Eccles, but I was shocked that having grown up and, you know, went from preschool to through ninth grade in Utah, I never heard about Mariner Eccles. Wow. I didn't hear about Mariner Eccles. You know, there are just about every city has an Eccles building because Mariner Eccles' brother has a huge philanthropy. And so, you know, they sponsor the arts. Just about, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but you know, they sponsor a huge portion of the arts in the Intermountain West area. But I didn't know who was behind that name, much less, you know, where they came from. So I just kind of fell in love with this man's story. And it's an incredible story. I mean, he was the firstborn child of the second wife of a Mormon polygamist family in Cache Valley, Utah. And his father was incredibly industrious and owned a conglomerate of companies, died when Eccles was pretty young. And, you know, Eccles part of the family and ended up inheriting 2/7 of David Eccles, his father's estate. And Eccles really, Mariner really ends up by just kind of sheer power of will and some kind of innate business acumen, just kind of just expands this empire and ends up kind of taking over a lot of what had been inherited by the other side of the family. Then makes just this really interesting jump from business mogul in Utah, gets into banking, kind of forms the first bank holding company in the country, where he's got a couple of these different banks owned throughout the Mountain West. And
for some of our listeners who might not know, what is a bank holding company?
Sure. So there was a time, actually, until I don't know, the 80s or 90s, I don't remember exactly, one of you might know, it was illegal for a bank to have branches in multiple states. What ended up, Eccles was the first to do this, but then this became really popular. But a way of getting around that is you could have somebody, or you could even have a company that owned banks in different states. And so it was effectively like having a branches across different states, except for instead of being branches, they were actually technically different banks, but they were just owned by the same person. So that's a great question. So he was kind of the first to say, well, I'm going to kind of group these different banks together and kind of put them all under one umbrella. The Great Depression hits. He manages to keep his banks alive through classic, you know, Jimmy Stewart moments of, you know, literally he in his memoir, he documented experience that's almost straight out of It's a Wonderful Life.
I wonder if there's an actual connection between the two. I mean, because it's a great story. It's a,
you know what? That is a great comment. I don't know. But it's worth looking into. It's definitely worth looking into because it's straight out of it. You know, the only addition is that in Eccles' story, the Fed arrives right before he's about to give his speech. So Eccles jumps on the counter and, you know, he tells the people, hey, you know, we're okay. We're going to stay open as long as you need. Things have been running a little slow. Sorry about that. Although he had said previously that he wasn't sorry. That had been the instruction that he'd given, you know, slow everything down, make them sign for stuff. So what would become kind of classic bank run protection methods, he invited the Fed to come up. The Fed came with some hard cash. And after he finished speaking, he said, you know, this Fed guy is gonna say a few words. He kind of caught the Fed guy by surprise. The Fed guy stands up on the counter and says, yep, everything that Mariner has said is right and everything's going to be okay. And it's just, you know, so he gives some speeches in Utah about banking and banking's response to the Great Depression, catches some eyes of some East Coast bank people that invite him to DC. He ends up getting looped into FDR's, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president at the time's circle. FDR invites him to stay on. And, you know, it's kind of the starting story. He spends time with FDR. He plays a huge role in the remaking, or honestly, the second birth of the Federal Reserve in the 30s. FDR effectively offers him the job. Eccles says, I'll take it on some conditions that the central bank be changed in a certain, you know, in a few number of ways. And I can go on and on. You know,
he basically single-handedly centralizes power in the FOMC and in Washington, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the FOMC effectively didn't exist. You know, there were some informal gatherings of, you know, groupings of some coordination. But yeah, he says, you know, you're exactly right. He says, we're going to consolidate. If we're going to be a true central bank in the spirit of the, you know, the Bank of England or the Western European central banks, then we need to do this. So he does. And then he's got interesting stories of how he left the Fed. And,
So I'll take power, but as long as I get all the power.
That's effectively. And
he was also pretty instrumental in reforming the American financial system, in particular with mortgages, right? I mean, he's behind the 38 Act that kind of nationalizes and securitizes the mortgage industry in America.
That's right. Right? Oh yeah, he's at fundamental tipping points of history for decades. And then, you know, in his personal life, it's not just his, you know, what his contribution there is, personal life, you know, coming from, you know, polygamist family in Utah to, you know, he had a long marriage with his wife. And then in the end, he was divorced and married someone from Washington, D.C. that he had met there. You know, he ran for the U.S. Senate after leaving the Federal Reserve. He lost, you know, I think he ran. Anyways, there's a lot to the story.
I think for us, the interest in him comes from the fact that he's, although he's not remembered as the American Keynes, because people call Alvin Hansen the American Keynes. Eccles was there first, earlier, and arguably more strongly, right?
That's right.
He had policy leverage, right? I mean, he picks up on Waddell and Kaestings' underconsumption theory, that what is really going wrong in America is that the poor don't have enough money to buy the things that people are producing. And so there's, you know, it's basically a modern version of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, right? Is that, like, there's this structural tendency for the economy to get into trouble when there's massive amounts of inequality, especially because that tends to create debt.
That's right.
And so what you need to do is you need to really attack. I mean, this is like straight out of FDR, right? You need to attack the economic royalists in order to set the economy right. And so he's actually the guy that comes up with the idea that the Federal Reserve can only do so much.
Right.
Right. You know, you can lower interest rates to zero, but they won't go below zero. After that, printing money is just pushing on a string.
That's right.
And so then you need this kind of like muscular fiscal anti-poverty program to really go forward. And he thought that the FHA was one of the answers to that.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Somebody someday will write the hearty Mariner Eccles biography that we all need.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, our time is up. Thank you, Caleb, for coming on. This has been really informative.
Absolutely.
I urge everyone to go check out the Bankster podcast and to check out that really wonderful encyclopedia of financial crisis history.
Appreciate it. Really great chatting with both of you guys. Look forward to the many episodes that are coming.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson, with assistance from researchers Jackson Overpeck, Sophie Stuckenberg, and Rohan Venkat. The podcast is supported financially by the University of Chicago Program for Professional Advancement and Training for Humanists and Humanistic Social Scientists, the Micro Metcalf Internship Program, as well as the University of Michigan UROP Program. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.